everyone. Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis, a bi-monthly, that's right, we're doing it twice a month now, Atlanta Podcast. Once upon a time, we were once a week. And you know what? It's okay. We are now bi-monthly. Sometimes you'll get more. But let's go for 2 a month right now, every other week, something like that. On today's program, you know what? Before we get to that. Hey, before I begin, I want to give a quick shout out to Val, who set me up with the great interview that I just did with Pat from the White Bull. P.S., by the way, went back to eat at Pat at the White Bull, and it was amazing. And if you watch my Instagram story, you saw a little bonus, special guest, special famous person that walked in, and a really awkward interaction. If you don't know about that, then you should probably start following me on Instagram. Oops, just banged my arm. But anyway, Val is the one who set this up. I will tag her company, her PR company, in this post. As I've said, many PR people are on the lame side. I don't know. Sorry, PR people. You can be on the lame side. But she's great, and I had lunch with her today at Hawkers, which I'd never been to before. Hawkers is Asian street food on what they're calling, I don't know, SPX Alley, Studioplex Alley. I'm not sure I'm down with the name, but it's the new end of the east side of the Beltline. The east side of the Beltline used to end at Jake's Ice Cream, and basically you get off and there's Krog Street Market, Catty Corner. Now there's a whole shitload of restaurants and stuff popping up down there. We had a brunch there today, and it went great. And so I want to give a shout out to Val, and as I said, I will tag her company in the show. On today's program, Winona Satcher. Winona, as you will learn, I met over a year ago, and we were going to have her come on the show. But everything happens in the time it's supposed to happen, and I saw her at Creative Mornings, thanks to my man K-Staps, who got me in on a sold-out show. Thanks, K-Staps. Another guest from a few weeks ago. These are great episodes you should listen to, by the way. Listen to Pat, which was the last episode, and Kyle, which was the last or maybe right before that. So I just want to say that I was very impressed with Winona, seeing her speak, and got to like her even more sitting here talking to her. I the only way I know how to say this is a lot of people say they're about making shit happen, and sometimes there's just a lot of talk or a lot of let's do this because it makes us seem like we're really doing the right thing. But this woman is about doing awesome stuff here in Atlanta, which makes her a perfect guest for the Atlanta Podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. We talked for a long time, and anytime I talk for somebody for over an hour, it means it was a good chat. Away we go. I want to start with your rad t-shirt.
Oh, thank you.
Because I live in the West End.
You do?
I do.
Well, I'm originally from SWAT, so it's literally making a complete cycle coming back home to where I'm originally from. So I had to get the shirt.
Where did you go to high school?
So my family, generations upon generations and generations, were all from Pittsburgh, SWAT Zone 3, Southwest Atlanta, and then and West End as well. We ended up moving out like a lot of families did, specifically African-American families, to see if that American dream actually worked. And so I ended up going to, most of my schooling was in DeKalb County. So, Smoke Rise, Tucker High School, Lakeside, that's where I went to school.
Yeah, I have a friend who moved to Smoke Rise, and I'm like, nobody knows what Smoke Rise is.
I didn't know.
Just say fucking either. Stone Mountain.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was either.
But here's the thing. I met you at Genius Atlanta.
Yes.
I liked you. I said, I should speak with this woman. Mm-hmm. Then there you were on the stage there at Creative Mornings.
Yep.
And almost the very first thing you said was, I'm a gentrifier, and I've been on the other end of gentrification.
That's correct.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that.
Mm.
So my ears perked up.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I feel similar.
Mm-hmm.
I moved to the West End 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some stuff that went on that I didn't think was cool.
Mm-hmm.
And when I spoke up about it, it did not go well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It was, who are you,
mm-hmm.
whitey?
Yep.
We live here.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you?
Mm-hmm. That's to be expected.
Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure what to do about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like there was an assumption there, And I'm like, I'm renting in this neighborhood.
Sure.
I'm renting in this neighborhood because I had to sell my house in Kirkwood because I can't afford it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Anymore.
Right.
So, like, we're here together.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what happened.
Right. No. And I feel the same way, at a different part of the spectrum. And so my husband, who is also white, feels the same way you feel. But the reasons behind why we feel the way we do, you know, clearly are reflected, or they do reflect the experiences that we've had. And so and talking with some of my buddies from Atlanta influences everything about the same idea behind being a recipient of communities that are most negatively impacted by gentrification, but also being a gentrifier, means that we have learned from experiences of how to approach change, because that really is the only constant. But then what we learn from being a recipient, how do you then take that and switch it to an opportunity to build equity, literally build it, but also practice it, build it for others, be more inclusive, but also demand that the way we want to change together is quality. And what does that actually mean? That means that people need to get their damn preposition straight. So either you're going to be in the community or you're going to be of it. And for me, it's being of it. And what I find is that there are some people, unfortunately, young people as well, who don't even really know their history and the history of Atlanta. And they want to live in the community. They want to do whatever the hell they want to do at all parts of the times of the night. But they're not of it. They don't understand that what they do affects other people, especially those that are seniors, elderly, and working class. And that's the problem I have. So, yes, there are spaces that should be available for everyone, which there aren't. So that's one problem. That's a whole systems conversation, a whole deeper conversation, where people can go and be who they are, regardless of the time of night. But then there are also spaces, specifically community spaces, neighborhoods are designed to work a certain way, which is to be able to relax, come home. That's your temple. That's your meditative space. That's your workspace. And that's your space to be as creative as possible. That should not be disturbed either. So it's a very fine line between what is accepted, what is allowable, and what is right for as many people and as inclusive as possible. So that, and how do you reconcile that? And I think it's how you define gentrification in the first place. So is it solely about race, which also is a social construct, or is it also about class? And that's a whole different conversation. And that can crisscross, we know, but that's a whole different conversation. I mean, I've seen people who look like me, other African Americans, who define gentrification as their way of being better than someone else. And what I mean by that is in the negative light. I don't mean it by saying no one should be better because I feel that I am, because I try to be better than what I was 2 minutes ago. But what right. I mean by that is being better and having more opportunities, at least you think you do, compared to someone and how you treat them. And so I've seen that as well. So clearly we have other conversations, or we should be having other conversations around what gentrification actually means to you. That's what it meant for me. And that's how I reconcile the notion that, hey, I've learned, I've evolved, I've grown, I moved away, I came back, and now I'm practicing revitalization a little bit differently. And I look differently than those that people think are automatically gentrifiers. So it's tricky, but it's real. And that's just the way I feel about it.
Well, I think, so I grew up here. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in the very standard suburban Marietta, upper middle, 80s and 90s.
Right.
This is where white folks live.
Mm-hmm.
We don't go downtown.
Mm-hmm.
You're going downtown for a concert? Lock your doors.
Yep.
Okay, that's when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I've been alive, not just Atlanta, but everywhere, was this concept of we got to make Atlanta cool. We got to make it safe. Let's get rid of the homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, here we are. In this like, oh, in town is happening thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm real curious to see what the long-term effects are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because once upon a time, as soon as you had a kid, it was get the fuck out of the city.
Right.
We got to go to the safe suburbs.
That's right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, gated, maybe not gated, but certainly not a lot of folks of color.
Mm-hmm.
So now here we are where young people, like, their 20s are spent on the Beltline.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to stay here?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of neighborhoods are we going to see? Or are we still going to always have these different pockets of black, white?
Mm-hmm. In this system, yes, you're going to still have those pockets. And it's interesting, the dynamics, because part of my growth growing up wasn't just in the urban core, it was also in suburban Atlanta, because that was what we thought we should be doing as African-American families migrating for more options. And part of it, too, was just that the way land use and zoning and all those things work, we don't want people living in cities anymore. We want to build more streets and more highways to get people out of the city, live in the suburbs. So that means all the resources go out with it. So, of course, once that happened, there were no resources either for African-American families to remain in the city because of that purposefully being done and how our communities were built and spread out. And then you have sprawl and the rest is history. But what's interesting is when you said that, how you grew up in Marietta a certain way and you have gated communities and some that you don't. Well, when we moved to the suburbs, Morrow, Georgia, before we went to Stone Mountain area, we had gates too, but those gates were put up only after we moved there. So we had neighbors that fenced themselves in because we were the only black family on the block. And so then the definition of a gate changed and the definition of progress changed. And we realized we were kind of in the same space that we were, it just looked a little differently. You also begin to see fences and gates go up in the urban core, but those were for public housing. And so what you learn is that, and actually CeeLo said in one of my favorite Goody Mob songs. Well, actually, I love all their songs. But, he wondered if the gates were put up to keep crime out or keep their ass in. And so these are the sorts of symbols that we really don't have a conversation about. That's where brand and marketing comes in. And when we were at Genius Atlanta, which is where we met, I mentioned that about the Beltline, and that if people will start marketing it, if the Beltline will start marketing it as a civil rights conversation, then all of a sudden, we can begin to have better conversations around what city do we want to be. Because right now, those young 20, early 30-year-olds who just love Atlanta all of a sudden and love the Beltline because it's a trail don't seem to realize that, no, it's more than that. It's its own neighborhood. It's its own space where I don't particularly feel safe on the east side and you don't feel safe on the west side. So... it seems to be becoming its own postillion.
Well, let me ask you, mm-hmm. when you say you don't feel safe, you mean if you're going up and down Ponce City Market, mm-hmm. you feel eyes on you, or?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Eyes on you. And trust me, I know the feeling, because I have had to deal with this since I was a kid and being taught at an early age. This is what these symbols mean. But eyes on you, automatically feeling like, because you're treated as though you're going to do something you're not supposed to do, even though I'm just walking along the Beltline. You don't see a lot of diversity as much as you should on the Beltline. A lot of that has to do with what's around the East Side Trail of the Beltline and what's not around the East Side Trail of the Beltline, which is housing affordability, which is a little different than affordable housing. You also feel like you're going to be trampled, not by someone who has a weapon, or a gun or whatever, but someone who has a bike that's going 1,000 miles an hour because you're walking too slow. Or someone that feels like, why aren't you on the West Side Trail? You should be over here. You should be over there where you belong, not over here on the East Side Trail where everything seems to be lily white. In a sense, unless I should be working at Ponce City Market making less than minimum wage and I can't live there. So that's, and then you hear stories about, or someone else just got robbed on the West Side Trail, someone else just got hurt in the West Side Trail. I've been on the West Side Trail. I can walk to the West Side Trail from my house, and I've never had, not saying that there are no problems, but I've never had a problem.
I'm on there almost, I don't want to say every night, but I've been running mm-hmm. since it was dirt.
Yeah.
When I moved there, they broke the ground.
Right.
And it was mud for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I've never felt unsafe.
Yep.
I did have a dude. I had a weird interaction with a dude the other day about it. But what I like about the West End Trail is that it's slow enough now mm-hmm. that I can wave to every single person.
Right.
And I really try to do that. Right. I try to how can I own my neighborhood? How can I actually be in the solution? Mm-hmm. So even if I'm running, kid with a stroller, kid on a bike, couple, whatever, I try to give a nod, I try to give a wave, mm-hmm. hey, this is our, mm-hmm. let's make it feel like a neighborhood.
Right.
And, so one of the very first guests I had was Gravel, And we had this very, well, it, I didn't think it was that intense, but apparently it was where we had some back and forth and you'd have to go back and listen to it. But we, I think we kind of disagreed a lot. And I feel like the East Side was the East Side because it all, like all those neighborhoods existed and they had a massive head start. Right.
That's right.
They had this massive head start. Right. So these neighborhoods that were already coming around now, okay, cool. Now we can connect them all. Mm-hmm. And then we throw in the big Pond City Market and we're off and running. Mm-hmm. The West End looks nothing like that.
Right. No, it's all
looks
different.
Nothing like that.
Right.
So almost like, it's almost like a whole way to start fresh because they also, East Side, they kind of did it ass backwards and here all the access points, there's access points.
Right.
And it's right to the neighborhoods.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Right in these neighborhoods. Like, oh, cool. People are going to actually, it's not just about going to Pond City Market. It's about a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so how do you feel about the whole, like, the whole Monday Night Garage, five breweries thing? Because I feel like we could probably use some other stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a different type of development, you know, clearly more commercial on the East Side, extremely more residential on the West. That's just how that development is. And has been, but I feel like there are some missed opportunities looking at historical significance. Again, we have to look at historical significance when you're moving forward with how you design and develop communities. So if you're looking at the East Side Trail, please remember, historically, that area, with if you're looking at Ponce de Leon, that was the racial mark north-south for the majority of the city of Atlanta. And so hence, you start, and you can see it now, the roads changed. If you go from Jackson Street Bridge, all of a sudden that name changes when you cross Ponce to a different name. You go to goes to Monroe. I mean, all these names shift because you had different types of development. Boulevard was known as a certain thing before. Now it's, you know, it, a long time ago it was known for a certain thing. Now it's changing, of course, on the other side of Ponce de Leon has changed. You can actually see that along the East Side Trail of the Beltline. That follows the historical footprint of what was already laid and the land use policies and everything that came from that. That to me was never reflected upon when they were doing the engagement and the, to me, of course you can't think of everything, but that's critical when you're talking about how are you going to connect all these different neighborhoods and all these different people if you have not really talked about the historical significance of what was already there and why it was there in the first place. That's number one. And so that takes you to Southwest Atlanta and the West Side Trail and what does that look like historically from a more residential footprint. Now you're starting to see, you know, like I said, Monday Night Garage and all, and the breweries and distilleries coming, which is really great from a commercial standpoint. I personally would like to see, though, those companies and small businesses that hire from those communities locally and pay well, not just those that you can walk into if you can afford to eat there. And then the developers that own those properties, to see those developers more interested in engaging small business and entrepreneurs.
Do you know those folks, the Lee and White folks?
I know of them, and I've spoken to them.
Okay.
Even about my own company.
Okay.
And again, it's one of those things, and it's a systems thinking approach. It's not just for those developers to engage the communities. It's in those neighborhoods. It's for the Atlanta Beltline partnership to engage as many developers to be as inclusive as possible. Because if you engage inclusive and what I mean by that is developers who one of their priorities is to be inclusive as far as who their tenants are. So if you don't even engage and work very smartly about how you put together your RFPs and RFQs, how you engage developers who care about inclusivity and equity, then their outreach is going to reflect that. I'm not sure that that's happening.
What if I told you I'm at once very hopeful and very cynical about the world in all of its forms? Mm-hmm. And the very cynical me says, and this is the kind of conversation I had with Gravel, was at the end of the day, money's going to do what money wants to do, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, quaint little neighborhood becomes whatever the public's movie theater is happening on, what's that road? Bill Kennedy, right? Whatever that thing, like that's what's always going to happen.
Right.
Because if developers had their way,
the Fuqua development,
they're going to fucking put shopping malls everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And they don't care about folks of color. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's where the money is. This is what we're going to do.
Right. Right. Well, and that is an honest way of looking at the situation. It's not just Atlanta, it's everywhere in every
right.
major city, because that's the truth. And so it requires, though, and I spoke a little bit about this quickly at Creative Mornings, it all comes back to the land, and it all comes back to how you policy that. So if policymakers don't build equity and inclusion into how they do their if they even create design standards for buildings at one scale, and that matters.
What does that mean?
So in other words, you see a lot of renovations where everybody thinks that they're Chip and Joanna Gaines in West and all these other communities, and they're not.
Who's Chip and Joanna Gaines?
HGTV, Fixer Upper.
Oh.
Yeah. So everybody thinks that's, you know, and there's no city-wide policy of design standards that says this is how you keep the historical context of your spaces. And that's important because, especially in the South, where there's a reason for porches, there's a reason why you have the kind of, what porches do is it allows you to have a semi-public, semi-private space to your neighbor on the sidewalk, to your neighbor next door. It creates almost a familial sense on the streetscape. It brings the street back to the pedestrian. And these are very minute ways of looking at it, because I'm a designer. So all of that matters when you're talking about how you include and incorporate people versus taking porches off or building something that's completely out of the context and you lose the legacy of those communities. So that's one. So there's no design standard. And then that goes to the commercial spaces. In commercial buildings, how are we building our buildings where they are up to the street, where they're pedestrian focused, where they provide spaces where you feel safe and secure for everyone, and that everyone's welcome to come in? All of those things can be policy. Those are inclusive, inclusion, equity conversations. Then with that being said, having policies and land use changes and shifts where you're not continuing to build off these legacies of segregation for the purposes of integrating, but you're actually zoning your properties, you're zoning mixture of uses in a way that does create platforms for inclusion in commercial spaces that are affordable as well. What you're seeing is that cities will say, well, we will give all these tax credits, which I question a whole lot because they don't always work, especially in this administration. If you put in a certain amount of affordable housing, which is very little, we'll give you gazillions of dollars of tax dollars and tax credits. That does not provide the inclusion that we seek, because people should be able to live, work, play, and innovate where they are. And what we're working on with our company, Maker Studio, is the opposite. Can we work with key public-private partners and developers and reimagine and redefine what equity and inclusion means in the civic space? And what I mean by that is, and you hear it now where you see all these RFPs put out by the Beltline, other developers saying in opportunity zones, we want to use these opportunity zones only on the West End or only on the West Side. And you know, you mentioned Ryan, who's great. They're working on the West End Mall development
right.
as an opportunity zone.
Right.
And so it's basically, you know, what can we do with rich people's money to bring opportunity into? I mean, that's really what opportunity, and that's what opportunity zones are. And put them in places that are disinvested and disenfranchised. And I totally get it. What does that mean? Well, so without going into the dynamics of opportunity zones, but basically you're taking wealthy people's money and you're putting it into zones of opportunity, not to use the word over and over again, to build new commercial spaces, more residential spaces, to build up disenfranchised and disinvested communities. But you only see these pockets of opportunity zones in low-wealth communities, in disinvested communities. My issue with that is, if you look at, and I mentioned this at the Creative Mornings talk that I did, over 130 years plus of housing segregation and racism and inequities, the main component of all of that is that we have segregated our land uses where only public housing and only workforce development housing and only supportive housing only go into communities of color. So we are still, if that's the plan, is to only have opportunity zones where you're bringing in affordable housing and affordable commercial spaces only in communities of color, you're still segregating land uses. What we're saying is, no, if you want to build opportunity, your opportunity zone should be in Buckhead. Your opportunity zone should be in Midtown, where we have...
They don't want you there.
Of course they don't. Of course they don't. And I lasted, 4.5, 5 years when I worked for city government? For a reason. And I left. I used to work in the city of Durham, North Carolina. And it didn't. I couldn't do it anymore.
But that's the thing about it is you say, oh, well, we need like basically government to do right by folks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, here I am. That's like, all right. Well, good luck with that.
No, they're not. It's not. I mean, that's not what it's built to do. And I had to learn that the hard way. And so for me, it's not about shifting existing the way government works today. It's not about changing that system because the system is doing exactly as it's supposed to do. It just doesn't work for me, but it's working for certain people. My point is creating a whole new fucking system. Like that's where I am at this point because I've been on both sides. I've been the recipient, but I've also worked in government. I'm part of that whole gentrification space. And so I see how they literally feed off each other. That's not, to me, progress. And one of my kindred spirits who is no longer with us, Herman Russell, who pretty much built most of Atlanta and set the platform, and I love his book, by the way, one of the best books I've ever read. One of the things that the main thing I took out of his book was that it's all about knowing your role. And he was talking about in this book when he would talk with Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Nader Abernathy, they were over his house. And he was like, man, I need to be out protesting with you guys. I'm over here building shit. Like, I need to be at the forefront. Tell me what I need to do. And they told him no. MLK Jr. was like, no, you're exactly where you're supposed to be behind the scenes. Everybody can't be on the forefront. And I took from that, everybody can't be about tearing shit down. Some of us got to be about building shit up, right? And so while you're over here tearing down, protesting, and that's great. Everybody has a role to do. Some of us have to say, okay, how do we maintain legacies of integration in a way that's equitable? How do we continue to, you have to build it. You can't just talk about it. And that's one of our problems. Everybody wants to talk about equity. Nobody wants to build it. So this current system doesn't allow for that conversation. But we are trying to create our own conversation, our own systems, knowing what we know now. And that is, if you want opportunity, if you are truly about affordable housing affordability, then it has to be next to you. You can't just say, I want it, but only if it's on the west side. That doesn't work. It hasn't worked, and it's not working now. So why aren't those same tax credits provided for developers in Buckhead? Why aren't those same tax credits?
Right, but I don't expect them to ever change.
But the government won't. The government won't. But if we are diligent and if we are correct in our thesis, and I believe we are, and in talking about this, more people know who I am because of a podcast like this and Creative Mornings, I'm starting to feel and I'm starting to hear and get hints at those private individuals with those private dollars who can bring money and resources to helping us actually build out the equity that we want to see. So I have completely given up on running after government entities to do that. It's just not going to happen. What we're focusing on as a for-profit social enterprise is going after those impact investors, whether it's resources or technical, but anybody that wants to make an impact with the resources that we have.
Okay, so, and I totally want to get into like what those spaces are because you and I know what they are,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we haven't got into that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about, how do I phrase this? Rich people saying, okay, this is cute and it makes me feel better about
right.
myself.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give this woman a few dollars to build a couple of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know which probably doesn't have any long-term value?
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
no.
Do you turn people, do you turn those people's money away? Or do you say like,
no.
If you're not going to help for the right reasons, like,
mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
No. So it's funny. No, that's a great question. So we're starting to finally gain traction in our work. And we've gotten calls from Dunwoody. We've gotten calls from all over within the city of Atlanta and the metro Atlanta. And the first thing that people say to me is, we love your impact and what you're trying to do first. That's the first thing they say. I'm like, great, because what I've realized that when a client is interviewing you, you should be interviewing them as an entrepreneur to make sure that your values align. Now, if someone wants me to build $1 million home at a shipping container, I'm going to do it as long as, of course, our values align. Values meaning you pay us on time and you pay us for what we're worth. I have no problem with that.
So if you're saying I want the dope tricked out version,
yes.
You'll totally build it for
We are a for-profit company. We are a for-profit company.
I'm just imagining like the most
yeah.
gaudy,
yeah.
thing.
And they're out there. Now, it's going to look right we're going to follow zoning and regulations and any, if there are design standards. And of course, we don't think we're tacky, so we're
right. All right, let's get to that, because I'm gonna in the intro of the show, I will talk about what you do, but I'd much rather you do it. So let's actually let's not assume that anybody listening knows what those spaces are called or what they are.
So I'm CEO and founder of Makers Studio LLC, and Makers Studio is an urban design, social enterprise, and modular design built company. We use shipping containers. We customize them and refurbish them and recycle them, upcycle them into creative turnkey spaces, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's commercial spaces, affordable entrepreneurs. And that's how we started. So we started with this notion of saving the world. We're going to build affordable housing and entrepreneurial spaces out of shipping containers so people can live, work, play where they are. the real world said, think again, try it a little differently, pivot.
As it often does.
As it often does, which was a great pivot. And it was, you need to make money so that you can then make your impact.
Right.
So that's where we are now. And it's funny because all of our main, our first clients have been wealthier commercial spaces, which is has nothing to do with our social impact, what we want to do as far as affordability. However, those individuals are like, you know what, if we can do this project for us, we just need to do something quick, turnkey, that puts our name as a company, our name out there. How can we then help you promote what you're doing from a social piece? Perfect. Because it's not always about the money, the revenue you make. It's also about the opportunity to be able to tell my story with someone who has that network that I can go tell my own story to them. So that's how it's been working. Now, that's part one. Part two is I call the backdoor strategy. So one of our clients, we are building an ADU, which is an accessory dwelling unit. And that has been a big conversation, not just in Atlanta, but a lot of major cities about rezoning our communities to be able to build accessory dwelling units, i.e. granny flats. I don't call what we do tiny homes. I cannot stand that term. We are not building $400,000 homes on wheels. That's really cute. We don't do that. We are about...
Didn't that moment already end, by the way? It was a very hipster thing like 5 years ago, and now it's kind of already done.
I think so. I mean, the show's still on TV, but I don't think it's the same momentum as it was.
There's actually one sitting there on the west side.
It might be. So
right there by the Phoenix there, right where Adair Park is?
Yeah, it might be. So I know the MicroLife Institute, which is awesome, Will Johnson, he started out as tiny, and I think he said he was changing his name as well because of the... this context. And I actually was working on a committee with then council member Kwanzaa Hall about putting together an ordinance for expanding our zoning from R4 zoning to R5 zoning that allows for accessory dwelling units to be built citywide so we could promote affordable housing, these small spaces behind primary structures that could serve as 1 to 2 bedroom units that someone could rent out.
So how many square feet is the standard one?
So for me, I mean, for what we do with our shipping containers, they're versatile. But majority of the time, we focus on our 40-foot units, which are 320 square feet. So it's a one-bedroom, one-bath. These are residential units. And again, you can stack them. Our basic units, when we built them, we have heating and air. There's flooring. It's really beautiful spaces.
Can I ask you about that? Because I don't know if that came up at the Creative Mornings, but I assume it would get really hot and really cold and that it would be tough to manage that because they're made out of what?
Metal.
Right.
Steel. A lot of people think that. That's not true.
They don't get super hot in the summer.
No, because we use something called insulation and we insulate our walls. We follow the international building code.
So you don't need some massive thick ass insulation.
No, we follow.
Just like regular building a house.
Right. That's right. We follow international building code. And the bigger per square foot of our units, whether we stack them side by side or put them on top of each other, the cheaper they get per square foot. In fact, the bigger units actually are cheaper when you buy them as basic units before we upfit them than the smaller units are because of supply and demand. But no, we have everything is to the international building code. In fact, the Modular Building Institute, the International Building Code, the International Code Council voted in this whole new language that's going to be in the latest rendition of the International Building Code coming up, specifically geared towards shipping container construction because it's growing.
Right.
Our cities are growing rapidly. they're becoming more inequitable as they grow. And so, you know, people are like, we've got to find more innovative ways to provide more density, smaller spaces, versatile spaces for more people.
So I could stack them.
You can stack them.
Cut a hole in one, and now I've got a two-bedroom.
Now you've got a two-story, two-bedroom.
Right. And the plumbing issues.
Plumbing, same way you would a house.
Just goes right into the natural.
Right into the natural. Or, you know, or one of our clients we were actually doing in Pittsburgh, we're in Atlanta, we're actually doing a chemical toilet, kind of like an RV, inside the unit so that it can be serviced that way. The developer didn't want to dig down and connect to the utilities. So you can do that. Because the thing about containers, they're movable if you want them to. So you can pick them up.
Right. I mean, trailers are too, but they don't move.
Right. Well, no, they do unless a tornado comes and then you're fucked up. But with the container, those things are built, you know, they're built for hurricanes. Now, by City of Atlanta code permitting, we have foundation piers the way we do it under our unit. So they actually sit on all the structure support is at the corners, and so they sit on top of concrete piers. But we have to bolt them down to those piers. I mean, these things are 8,000 to 10,000 pounds. I mean, they're not going anywhere. In fact, it's been frustrating in talking with other cities who don't want to even talk about containers as an opportunity for modular construction in their city. Oh well, these containers went on. They're just going to fly away in a tornado. It's like, dude, if there's a tornado that's going to pick heavy enough to pick up a container, it's going to pick up everything else, including a car.
Right.
So, but I tell you what, if there's a tornado in Atlanta, I'm going in my container first before I go, in my house. I'm just letting you know. So, but those are the requirements, and we have gotten our containers approved. And what we love about them is their size. So I mentioned the Creative Mornings give me 8 feet.
Right.
They are 8 feet wide. So in spaces where developers they can't see where they make money off of building a structure because the spaces are awkward, they're tiny, you can use a container to do that.
So do you envision people buying them like homes?
Yes.
Or people buying them to become properties, to become like, okay, now I've got 20 of these things and I rent them out, or both?
Yeah, both. Both. And commercial spaces.
Right.
And commercial kitchens and whatever.
So the 8 feet thing is huge. And you say, and listen, we've all seen a lot of talks, a lot of TED Talks. We've all been to a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Anybody listening to this, whether it's for work or for play, whatever. And I got to say, like, you actually had an effect on me.
Oh, great. I hope it was a good one.
Well, you said the last thing you said was when you go to your car, look for 8 feet. And I did.
Mm.
And so you made an impact.
That's great.
So keep doing that.
Okay.
That worked for me. Mm-hmm. And now that we're talking about it again, so let's talk about this Monday night garage space. So for those that don't know, in the West End where I live, so I live right across from there. I live like Rose Circle Park.
Yep.
Like that's where I live.
Yep.
White Street.
Yep.
So Monday night garage was the first one. And now there's Hop City on the front end, and there's three or four more breweries and or distilleries coming. Mm-hmm. And then all this parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Could you or would you possibly like take some of that parking lot and be like, all right, we could put 10 of these things here?
We could, except the developer isn't interested.
Not interested.
Not interested.
But if they were.
But we could.
You totally could.
Oh, easily.
And is that the kind of thing that you see where someone's like, you know what? We got a shitload of parking lot that isn't used 95% of the time.
Right. I mean, and that's what I meant by our land use policies. And it has to change because we are still building as though we need all of that parking, but then we want to say that we are one Atlanta that's walkable and transit oriented. That those two don't mix.
Right.
And so my point is, now that we've built that infrastructure and it's never going to be in use 100%, we can use those 8 foot spaces to build in more density with housing, so that people who work at Monday Night Garage can actually live next to Monday Night Garage.
Right.
And then they can create a voice in a community that needs new ideas, young people who are coming up after us, who can then, they can put their...
I'm not a young person anymore.
We're not, I'm sorry.
You just bummed me out, dude.
Yeah, I know. I hate to break it to you, but I'm not either. But we need those spaces as platform to, and then also, those living in those spaces can see, or working in those spaces that we would build, can see opportunities for transitioning from a renter to a homeowner to a business owner, and not ever having to leave in that sense. And so it provides, our containers, our plug-in pods, which is what we, the reason we call them plug-in pods is because we're plugging into the existing context. We're not pushing, trying to push anyone out.
Right.
We're literally saying, this is what's here. How do we plug into,
right,
plug new ideas into these spaces in a way that's not displacing anybody?
Are you looking at the tons of strip malls that are dead,
yes,
and that people like have started to use for like churches or whatever else, because that's a lot of land,
yeah,
and, laying around.
Oh, huge, of course. And the utilities are already there. In fact, we got a call from Cleveland about a strip mall that's not in use.
Cleveland, Georgia?
No,
Cleveland, Ohio.
Of course, I told them that logistically you wouldn't want to pay us to build you anything from here because we're not at that scale yet, and it will be more expensive for you.
Well, could you introduce them to a local partner for them?
I did.
There? Okay.
Actually, I did. There is a CDC, a Community Development Corporation in Cleveland, who I met a couple of years ago through Next City, who's actually using containers to do, affordable food hall and market and things like that.
What about proximity to like each other? Like, is it just sort of like a condo situation? Is there too many that can be too close together? Is there noise issues?
No, I mean, they are versatile just like any other building, except you can move them, you can play around almost like Legos, you can fit them in really odd spaces. My husband and I are both landscape architects, and so the opportunity to then not only design the space, but the site around it and all of the components that go into access into the site, access out of the container, access to the street, to green spaces. I mean, we literally are a one-stop shop. That's what we're trying to become, where we care about not just what happens internal to the structure, but also external from a community standpoint. So you can build as much as you want. In fact, we love talking about our plug-in pods as multifamily and mixed-use developments that are stacked, that are quite large.
How high would you want to stack them?
So safely,
it gets unsafe?
Yeah. So safely, they're stackable 8 to 9 high.
And really?
That's what they do on ships. So if you look at a ship with, right, containers, that's what they're built for. So they're stacked. Now, of course, we have, and those are empty. Ours aren't empty. And so we have a structural engineer that makes sure that the uplifts and all those things are correct. Anytime we cut into our units, that we reframe them, because that's part of the other myth is, well, you're cutting into the container, so the structural integrity is gone. It's not gone, it's changed. Just like you would cut into a house, you reframe it. So that's what we do. Our welder, who is a woman who's awesome, which is one of the reasons why our company is what I consider a one-stop shop, not just for what products we make, but for who we serve and who we hire, is that we focus on hiring women, people of color, and refugees for our help us build our units. So we literally want people who build our units from the community so they build the change they want to see. So shout out to Magdalena for that one.
And then if I want one of these units, mm-hmm, not only are you going to build it for me, you're going to work with the local government to make sure it's all up to code,
yeah,
and all that shit?
Yeah, and that's rare, because the few container companies that are out there, we're not the only ones. We don't give a shit about competition. We don't concern ourselves with, so frankly, I don't feel like we have any. Most container companies, again, the few that are out there and a few that are here in Atlanta and Georgia, they just build it and drop them off. It's up to the owner to do whatever the hell. If you didn't get your permits correct, that's your problem. But now you got a container sitting in your yard, you have to deal with it. We don't do that. But you have to pay us to help you with that process. We are also planners. We're not just landscape architects. And so we help you with the permitting, that whole design concept, site design development. I'll give you an example. One of our clients, the couple owns a small beer company. And so when they approached us about doing an accessory dwelling unit, which was supposed to be a residential unit with space for the wife to work in as her office as well, that two things happened. One, when I started asking them more about, well, who are you and what do you do, because that's just what I do, realized they owned a beer company on the side. And I said, hey, you know, wouldn't your backyard be a really cool beer garden or a beer tasting space? Because they wanted to figure out a way to use their backyard more. And that's a good idea. And so we started working with them as landscape architects now, of looking at their space in a different way, the outside, the exterior space, and then how does that connect to the actual container structure? So we are design builders of the plug-in pods. We are landscape architects helping them with the site development and reimagining their space to get its most efficient use as possible. And then the second thing happened, or actually the third thing happened, which was, so, and I call this the backdoor strategy, going back to your the question earlier about governments just not going to do the right fucking thing when it comes to inclusion and equity and housing affordability. So what I did was I said, you know, do you realize that you're asking me to build an ADU? Well, what's that, Winona? It's an accessory dwelling unit. Well, what's an accessory dwelling unit? Well, accessory dwelling unit is this, is this, is this. It's an opportunity to build housing affordability in spaces that the market says no longer, that you can no longer do because it's too expensive. Really? Yeah, so you're actually building an affordable home. We are. Yep. Okay. And that's how we got in.
Right.
So I didn't approach them. My engagement strategy wasn't the front door saying, you've got to build an affordable
right,
house.
Right, right, right.
Because you're gentrifying, you're part of the problem.
Right.
No, my engagement strategy was based off my own experiences as being both a recipient of gentrification and a gentrifier. I know you want to make this community better. You're also an African-American couple, like myself, who now lives in a space that a lot of African-Americans and our white brothers and sisters can't also afford. Let me give you show you an opportunity of how to take what you actually want and market it and brand it just a slightly different perspective. Now all of a sudden, you're part of our social impact space. You are creating housing affordability whether you know it or not. You now have the power to do that. Oh, we didn't realize that's what that was. Tell us more. So that's how we were able to impact. We didn't come in first that way. We came in with what they wanted, which was a really cool, funky space. Then we said, you know, we can actually embrace your space by looking at the site better right. because of what you do. By the way, you're actually helping our social mission because now not only are you purchasing a, because what they're purchasing from us wasn't that expensive anyway, so it was an affordable unit. And what people have to understand about developers, and developers are correct, they're there to make money. I like making a return too. And so that means that I have to be able to not only provide affordable housing, I have to be able to build it affordably. So that's part of why we use shipping containers, because we can build the units affordably and sell them affordably as well, not just build something, it's expensive, and then we have to figure out how we're going to sell it for and not make a return. That's not right for me either. And so you have to look at it both ways of building and selling, and that's what we're able to do.
I think it's more of a side door thing. When you say back door to me, it sounds like maybe like sneaky, mm-hmm. like oh, we're coming around the back. But it's like, anyway, that's my personal.
I've actually thought about that, but I kind of like the sneakiness of it. Like, I like, why not? Because let me tell you what else was sneaky.
Well, I can tell you honestly, as a business owner, an entrepreneur, and anybody listening, sometimes you do know it's better for the client more than they do.
That's right.
But if they don't think it's their idea, then it's not going to happen.
Right. And what I mean by sneaky is that not sneakiness towards the client, it's sneakiness towards the system that has created the problem in the first place. Because what has been sneaky for over 130 years has been calling something and I talked about this, the many faces of the beast that we call racism, right? So it used to be called sundown towns, and it used to be called lynching, and it used to be called blockbusting, and then it became Jim Crow, and now it's called something else. So the sneakiness of the system is to change the name, but it's the same shit. So my thing is, how can I be sneaky in my branding and marketing to where we're creating a whole new system based off the sneakiness that worked for that? So if it worked for that, it's going to damn work for me. As long as I explain and educate, because that's also part of it, other landowners about why we're doing what we're doing. And so once that conversation took place, you saw this lift from this couple, like, wow, we actually can make a difference just in our yard. And I'm like, yeah, but multiply that times how many yards we could do this. And I was recently at another meeting where I pitched this notion. And people were like, well, how dare you tell us that we have to do affordable housing? What if I don't want to do affordable housing? And you're going to have, you know, thousands of people buy into this concept. And my answer is, no, we don't. If I have 10 people in Buckhead buy into this concept, I don't need 100. Where is this? Why are we in this system? And I call it the microwave bitch syndrome, where we have to have everything quick. We have to have like thousands of people to buy in for it to work. That's not right.
Right.
You only need 10 good, resourceful, high net worth, networked individuals to buy into it privately for us to be successful. I can't speak for somebody else. So that's what I mean by the back doors. And I kind of feel like it's going back to this whole notion of underground. Like you're cooking up something underground. You're getting your shit down to a science before you really come out with this whole idea, so that 1,000 people can buy into it. Our asses are coming in the back door for 10 backyards, and 100 parking spaces. That should give us enough traction that we need to make the difference that we're trying to create. So, One of my professors back at Auburn University in architecture school, landscape architecture program, told me to, what was interesting then, I didn't get it, but I get it now, and he said, Winona, you really should focus on this term called cellar door. And what actually is a cellar, and what does it mean to get out of that space and become anew and renewed? What does it mean from a design standpoint? I mean, it's highly philosophical, metaphysical, but when you really think about it, this notion of underground and this notion of exploring and experimenting in the cellar or behind the back door and coming in that way as a strategy, because by the time you release it, you're already fucking done. Like, it's already successful. We already know it works. So I'm not asking anybody if it works. What we're asking people to do is to find those 10 individuals who can see 8 feet differently, who can find those individuals who know developers or someone who has the resources to purchase property or to help us revitalize those 8 feet differently. That's what we're looking for.
But you are very smart. You're pretty well connected. I would think you could, because we joked and said, those people aren't going to do it. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, where are you with that? One of them, two of them, zero of them?
I would say we're probably at three or four.
Okay.
And but three or four different uses. So a couple commercial, one residential. And from the use standpoint, that's really all you need for people to see that it could work. And people, the human race, really, we're just kind of fucked up. Like, we're so reactive instead of proactive, and everything we're doing is proactive. And so that's the hard part about it, is to get people to be proactive about how they see the world and how they see their own backyard, not as a NIMBYist, but as someone that questions who they are and what is your role. So if your role is an advocate for affordable housing, then build the shit in your backyard. Don't say you have to build it over in the West End to be comfortable.
But again, here's this massive, like, I feel like, unanswerable question, right? So I live in the West End. What's over in the West End, right? Morehouse, Spelman, right? The whole historically black colleges. Mm-hmm. And those areas are not built up.
Nope.
People go to that school and do not come back and fix that part.
That's right.
So again, I feel like it's like, when is this stuff going to happen?
Well, it is very multidimensional.
Because we know there's a lot of black folks with money.
Yeah. It's very multidimensional. And what has happened, though, is we as a collective are trying to solve multidimensional problems with one-dimensional solutions, and they don't work. And so, to me, what it requires is, even in the HBCUs that are in the area at Georgia Tech, that are not that far from the HBCUs, it requires, it's a systems approach to this madness. And that is starting in middle school, in high school, all the HBCUs, Georgia, we need to have courses and curriculum dedicated to the history of land use and segregation, because that's where it all stems from. We need to also have initiatives in place where college students have access, and historically, HBCUs, more African-American students of color who typically don't have a lot of these resources, somehow get the funds. Do we find these private landowners, these other folks of color who have money, and say, hey, can you provide a way of a revolving loan fund or some mechanism where these young people have access to funding to buy the land around their universities, to build up their own communities? It takes money. So all this bullshit talking about inclusion and equity, if you don't have the money to do it and the land to do it, you can forget it. That's just it. And then with that being said, what do you do with it? You can't do piecemeal development, one little coffee shop over here, one over there. You really have to do district level development, right? And so you're looking at greenway systems, you're looking at belt lines, you're looking at those kinds of entities that have fingers and legs that go deeper into all of the aspects of neighborhoods. You have to think systematically about how you make system change. You can't think about it piecemeal. And that's a huge part of the problem. So it's an education piece, it's an energizing piece, and it's how you, and then it's shifting this notion of what it means to be successful. That's a whole nother conversation. For a long time, it means to move out and get the hell away versus stay here or come back, which is what I did, and re-energize, reconvene, reconnect, and then build up and build out.
All right. You said coffee shop, and it made me laugh, and this is why. Mm-hmm. I really want to support my local coffee shop. Mm-hmm. I go to Dunkin' Donuts all the time, which is basically become my local coffee shop because they know me, they know my kids, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I want to support the business owner of my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of coffee shops. However, do you know what I'm going to say?
Yep.
What am I going to say?
They're not good.
Well,
as far as the quality.
Well, first of all, like, are they open? Are they not open?
Yeah.
And I noticed they want to be a lot of things.
Yeah.
They want to be a jazz place and a comedy place and all these night things. Mm-hmm. And then I go for a cup of coffee at 8 a.m. and they're either not open or, oh, we don't have milk today or whatever. Yeah. I'm like, I can't come back here.
Yeah.
Or the Wi-Fi doesn't work. Right. It's like, come on, man.
No, I mean,
why do they, I mean.
Yeah. Well, a lot of that is that, and this is being very honest, and this is in a lot of cities, we don't have what I consider a true neighborhood level economic development organization. And what I mean by that is an entity that trains, educates small business owners on what that actually means and how to do that. Everything from signage, if you are going to open up a cafe, the quality of your product, what it means to be a barista, not just pouring something in a cup and then adding something you order and saying this is it. What does it mean to keep your hours consistent? How do you even get a business license? What does that look like? How do you have a POS system? Things that I'm still learning myself that nobody teaches anybody. Nobody inherits their, they're not inheriting their property, they're not inheriting their money. They're literally just, they got some money and they're going to do it, say, I can do it, and everybody can't. I've seen it time and time again, which is another reason why we did our shipping containers, because it allows people to be able to test their ideas in our coffee shops in smaller spaces more affordably before you decide to get a brick and mortar and then you go out of business.
Well, and by the way, lots of folks with money open up shit that goes out of business pretty quickly too. So,
but they can afford it. But see, they're privileged to not really care.
Right, I'm just pointing out that it's that I understand that not every business is successful and coffee shops open and close all the time. But I'm talking about, I just want to.
There's a huge amount of businesses that aren't successful in certain communities.
Right.
And that's one of those reasons. That's a big part of it. Is we have an economic development entity who I won't say the name that does a lot for corporate Atlanta, but does absolutely. And I was talking about this with my husband a couple of weeks ago. I was watching a couple of those. I forgot the names of those shows on Netflix. One was on street food, and then there was another one that was on just the differences of fried chicken in certain places or pizza in certain places. But the street food one really caught my eye. And I was so enthralled. I mean, I literally watched it like the whole day back to back, which does happen when you watch Netflix.
Of course.
Like that. But the reason why was because what they were talking about, and this was that the first, I guess, season was more in Asian countries, showcasing different foods and the history behind the street food, not going to some franchise place, but the people who are cooking out of their same pot they've been cooking in for 30 years in the best food that you can ever find. It keeps the history going, a legacy in the culture. But what was meaningful for me was that we're lacking in that. And the idea of, and this is just from a food conversation, which really for anything, but just talking about food. I mean, imagine if we could drive down RDA, our neighbor Abernathy, and you have the street filled with all of these street food vendors, Miss Carla Jane, who can, instead of charging $12 for a bowl of collard greens, you can charge $8. And they're the best collard greens you've ever had. And they're not called contemporary. They're called what they are, soul food, right? And they're not somebody coming from somewhere who says, this is my take on it. No, this is what it is. And Miss Carla Jane's making money, but all she does is sell that because that's what she's good at.
Mm-hmm.
But someone can fund her one of our plug-in pods or some space as a vendor. And then next door to her, you have someone that makes, I don't know, rhubarb pie. And then someone that makes neck bone, And so all of a sudden you begin to you have this entity that organizes this very neighborhood intersectional level of economic development. I hate the word empowerment.
It seems like that would occur organically because that's how we all started, right? We started with blacksmiths and this guy's got this and this guy's got this and this lady has that.
But it doesn't. And a big part of that is going back to land use. Land use, we have been zoned out of that way of living, of living and functioning as a society. In order to have a butcher that's affordable, in order to have a Baker that's affordable. They can't afford these spaces. Now, we have zoned that out. If they don't have a certain amount of parking, well, gee, I can't get in. I can't take my, what do you mean take my bike or take MARTA? Are you serious? Want to get mugged on MARTA? I can't come and walkable? Are you, yeah, that's great, but not in my neighborhood. You know? So we have zoned ourselves out of this inclusive, integrative, locally led economy. And so my thing is we've got to get back to the basics because that system actually did work for inclusion. Sweet Auburn Market, you know, that's where one of the only few places black farmers could even go to sell their vegetables. But that's all, I mean, just vegetables everywhere, outside, inside. I mean, that's where, and I think that's where people want to get back to. But because we don't have these conversations as civil rights conversations, as land use conversations, we're never going to get there. So when I was looking at that Netflix special or show, I said, boy, we need to have an entity, an economic development that can organize and have the resources to make that happen because people just can't by themselves. At least the people I'm talking about who don't have consistent hours at their coffee shops, you know, who don't know really how to maintain a successful business. And then once they get into the building, they can't afford it because they have all these things they didn't think about that they have to renovate. So that's where we come in as far as educating on why we are where we are, but also building spaces that can harness people like that, my next door neighbors in the apartment next door to mine, all of these people that have the most amazing ideas who never get heard because they don't either know where to get the resources, and even if they did, they couldn't afford the resources. Money makes money and poverty is expensive. And poverty doesn't make money unless you control the narrative, which people in poverty don't. So that's where we are right now. And I think it's really about getting back to the basics of looking at things as a civics lesson, a civil rights conversation. That's not what we do. And that's what I said about the Beltline. The Beltline is a civil rights conversation. And I've said that to some people, and they've gotten really pissed off at me about that. No, it's a trail. No, it's a, if you have a problem with certain people on a trail that don't look like you, if you have a problem with housing affordability and being next door to you, you have a civil rights problem. How dare you say that? Because it's the fucking truth. But now it's uncomfortable.
Right.
Because I've peeled back the layers enough for you to realize this is a basic human dignity conversation that you're not willing to have with yourself. Now you see that the Beltline is its own neighborhood. The East Side Trail is its own neighborhood. We don't all feel comfortable on the East, in that neighborhood. It's not a connecting piece yet because we never had that conversation. It's no different than transit. It's no different than John Lewis Freedom Parkway when the community was fighting that tooth and nail so there wouldn't be a highway going through there back in the, I guess, 70s, 80s. It's the same thing about the Beltline, and nobody's having these conversations that still work, in my eyes, that still work there today. So that's where we are as a company from our social enterprise piece.
All right, let's talk brass tacks. All right, ballpark. Mm-hmm. Okay, not exact. Let's talk costs. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's say the folks at Lee and White were like, "Yeah, man, we want these. Let's make this happen. Mm-hmm. Let's build 10 homes." Mm-hmm. Right? What is it going to cost me to build that?
Mm-hmm. So, just quick estimated cost.
And again, I know that like it's like any business. If you just say, "What does that cost me?" and you're like, "Well, I got to give you a while. I got to give you a proposal," and they're like, "No, just tell me what it costs." You're like, "Well, it's not worth my time to like just fuck with you." Like, right. Anyway, so I get that.
Yeah,
I'm just, people want to know.
Yeah. So, for like if we were doing a basic affordable housing unit, and some of our numbers that we run were based off of HUD numbers for workforce development housing, so 60% to 80% to 100% AMI.
Tell people what that is.
Area median income.
Okay.
So sorry, all these acronyms. Good old government acronyms. And so what we were looking at was a one bedroom, one bath, 320 square foot unit, basic build out for around $50,000, $45,000, everything included. So heating and air, everything, flooring, windows, whatever the case is, and you could rent them out for, if I was a developer that cared about that, you know, for $700 minimum dollars. Let's just estimate. There's a little bit more than that. Let's
right.
estimate that. But the cost savings, now from a cost per square foot, it seems expensive. Right now we're building them at about $150 a square foot. When we get a manufacturing space, we'll be able to lower that down to almost $100 a square foot, which will be great.
Because right now you order them from?
Well, right now we buy them from a global supplier and we build them on site. With a manufacturing space, we'll be able to build en masse, and we won't even have to get permitting from the city, at least city of Atlanta, except for when we connect them to utilities.
So I think $50,000, like to me, that's like screams the word affordable, mm-hmm. right? Even if you're not making a lot of money, you could, depending on how banks are going with like, you know, down payments and whatnot, mm-hmm. you could eventually own that thing outright.
You could.
It's not $300,000.
And it's not $300,000, not $200,000. And because this is a type of modular construction, we can build in half the time. So instead of waiting for something to be built in 15 months, a small garage conversion, we can build in a month less. And well, say a month or 2 months on site. We have manufacturing spaces, even 90. You can
build how
90,
long?
90 freaking days. You can
how long
build
are you?
20 units.
How far are you away from that happening? Having your own manufacturing plant?
Well,
and where would it be?
So yeah, such a good question. So we are, number one, we're working on gaining more traction, more contracts, more purchase orders, so we can show someone who has a manufacturing space that we can pay the rent.
Right.
So we are actively looking for manufacturing space, preferably on the west side or southwest Atlanta area, where properties are still pretty good as far as cost. But we are also looking at if there is just vacant land that we could build at least a 15 to 20,000 square foot space, warehouse space. And the reason why I say 25,000 square feet, that's our wish list of being able to build 10 units at a time, having enough space for a truck to come in and deliver and drop off units, having our own office, and our office spaces are actually in containers, which makes it easy to move and pick up.
Right.
And so we don't necessarily need this really big deal high-tech space. We just need a space where we can function and build en masse, get it permitted, and then just send them out to scale globally, not even just here in Atlanta. So we are actively looking for one investment. What I mean by investment, I mean workforce, $3.2 million of operational capital to get us up and running, to pay ourselves, for operations, hire staff to help us get these things out more efficient, more effective, equipment, materials. Also bring on some of our subs as permanent salaried workers, because that gets expensive. We have to keep meeting everybody on site. Now they can have a space where they can function and keep their tools. So we are in the market for looking at someone who's interested out there and partnering with us and discussing what kind of returns that would be, not necessarily equity in our company yet, because we don't have that. We haven't built that in yet. We're still small. But someone who might be interested in getting some return on cost when we sell our units, or even potentially, well, we don't rent them because we're not a property management company. But when we sell our units, getting a return off that and helping that pay back some investor. We do have one investor who's awesome. He was our first pre-seed capital investor. Reed is cool. And shout out to Kevin, my husband, who's also my business partner and basically builder of everything. But Reed was our first, after we crowdfunded for our first container build, Reed provided us with a small injection of some capital. And we're bringing him on as our CFO, as his equity in the company when we get to that point. So it's a delicate balance of getting more clients and more traction to show that when we do get a manufacturing space, we can either pay the rent or we just build our own. So that's where we are right now. So we've been talking with various entities, from the Arthur Blank Foundation in the West to other West Side and other organizations, to private developers who actually either have existing warehouse space on the West Side or have vacant lots where we can. Well, just
what about the old Pittsburgh yards there that they're doing a ton with?
So we are actually.
Can I announce your eye roll that just happened that no one can see, but I did.
Yeah, you can announce it. That is not. You can announce it.
That was a massive eye roll.
Yeah, Pittsburgh Yards is interesting. So we are actually doing two containers right now on Pittsburgh Yards.
Okay.
Luckily, shout out to C.D. Moody Construction. He's my mentor. In fact, I was just meeting with him yesterday. Huge, huge player in the construction industry, and one of the only. And he came out of the Herman Russell camp too, but an amazing mentor. If it was not for David Moody and his team helping us finish these units, we wouldn't be successful. But we are building. There's two containers on site already. If you're on University and facing Pittsburgh Yards, we're on the left of the huge 31-acre development. We are building two plug-in pods at our community engagement spaces. So one is a storage unit and one is a space for community members in Pittsburgh and Sylvan and the surrounding communities, Capital View, to come and meet on-site with the developers as they build out that site. And then they plan on moving them to a different part of the site. That process has been extraordinarily tedious and frustrating, but it has allowed us to get our foot in the door. It has allowed us to practice and to learn more about who we are as a company, to value ourselves more than when we started. And we met David Moody because of it. And so now we have this amazingly gifted and talented friend and mentor who is really our GC, a general contractor supervisor for all of our projects. So he has been an amazing help and will continue to be, and he's so excited about the work we're doing. So we are happy to be close to finishing our containers at Pittsburgh Yards and looking to be done with Pittsburgh Yards
soon.
Soon. For a lot of reasons.
Where else can people see stuff that's already done that they want to see what this is about?
So and it's funny because one of the reasons we took the Pittsburgh job was to get our feet in the door and to get our feet wet and to market ourselves. We actually didn't even really need it now that we have grown. So we built we have our own plug-in pod in West End that people can come and see. If they set up a time with us, go on our website, makerstudio.com, M-A-K-H-E-R-S. It looks like Mockers, but it's Makers. And they can, if they are serious about being a client, a customer of ours, they can come and see, touch, feel, walk through, understand how the space looks, how it feels. And every time we do that, people are like, oh, shit, it's actually nice. It's not dark. It's not creepy. It feels great in here. It's air-conditioned well or it's heated well. That is what has really... That's what's gotten us the traction in the marketing, because we haven't done any in marketing. I haven't even had the time, and I'm not really that good at it, to be honest with you, in this business. That is what has catapulted us already to a lot of interest.
So where is that one?
So that is in West End behind our house. And what's cool about that behind our house, number one, is our property. Number two, it shows that doing what we're doing, which was to show you can build these really cool micro units as an urban infill project on a small lot, that you can walk a couple of blocks to the Beltline, that you can walk 2 minutes to get on a MARTA station, which means you're within 5 to 8 minutes to the subway station, which means you are within distance of a lot of stops within the MARTA system, which means that you can have a primary structure there, or family living in a house in the same lot, if you need help or support, and you have this small space that now is yours, but you're still within the community that you feel safe and secure, but you can also give your voice to the future of that space. So it's a free lot in a sense, free as far as it's our lot, but it's also a great place to show how the whole system works in totality, how the pod works behind a permanent structure, how it all works together. We have some urban, some planters where we grow our own food, so people can see, oh, hey, that's actually a good idea. I can grow food here behind my house, which also supports a person that lives here who also might need healthy food as well. So it really does show this ecosystem that we're trying to promote as this inclusive and equitable way to build and infill. And we are really the missing middle. We're providing that missing middle piece of not necessarily single-family housing, but potential rental units in a space that rental units don't exist, or if they do, they're not up to a standard, or they're not affordable. And that goes back to the whole land use segregation issue. What we should be doing is policying, or putting in policy, I just made up my own word, putting in policy where we're promoting building affordability for single-family homes in underrepresented communities, and building a housing affordability as rental units in wealthier communities, not only rental housing in underrepresented communities and only single family. So we're doing it a little backwards. So what we're suggesting is this missing middle is a whole long spectrum of what that means. There's a missing middle of affordable single family housing in underrepresented communities that we can build on small lots or blighted properties that nobody's taking care of, but we can build there until we, and the other thing about our plug-in pods is, We can build the capacity and efficacy within communities, and then when someone becomes successful, move the shit out and build you a brick and mortar. But at least you've built up your clientele in an affordable way. At least we're providing spaces that are active, that were once not. We're putting more eyes on the street for half the time and half the cost. We can do that.
Are there other spots people can visit that aren't your house?
Well, when the Pittsburgh project is done, that will be one spot.
Okay.
And of course, that will be through.
Who's got that one on top of Crog Street Market?
I don't know who's.
You don't know who that is?
That is.
Okay.
And then it's not ours.
Okay.
And of course the one at Pittsburgh. I mean that would be. When that's done, I mean, that we don't own that. That is the Annie Casey Foundation. So, shout out to them. They own that site. That's their project. And so however they do their engagement,
right,
we have to contact them to come and see it. But that's that is our most public one right now. That's along the south side portion of the Beltline that will be, getting built soon. Or soon, meaning in the next couple of years, next year or two. That one, and then of course our house, that's a demonstration site, and that's invitation only. It's in the sense of contacting us first, and honestly, that's really off grid as far as I'm concerned. But people know, and what's cool about that is, people in the community walk up. People, our audience of people. Now and I have to tell people this all the time. If you are a naysayer and say it can't work, it can't be done, I'm a developer, I wouldn't do this, or I'm a single family, I own a single family home, I don't want that in my yard, or whatever. You're not our audience. Like, I don't give a shit what you want. We are not selling and marketing to you. The people who walk up and say, this is going to change how we view communities and will change my life because now I can live I don't have to be displaced. I can live right here and still be in the community, still be in a safe space. That's our audience. And that's what we get. People just walk up who still live in the area who haven't been displaced yet. Which is, I want to point that out. They're on that verge. They're like, this would save my life because now I can still afford to live in a place that's close to my work, that's close to transit, without being displaced, and be part of the change because it's coming regardless, and be part of that narrative, and be part of controlling that narrative of what it means to be in an equitable space. So that's our audience. And so when people come, we've had developers come from other organizations, and even they're like, man, this is. We didn't know it was this nice. You know, we hear container, like, what the hell? We thought it was we need to do this. How do we get in on this? You know? And so the other thing about developers is most developers aren't that innovative. They do the same shit everywhere. So it takes one or two developers to really get it, and that's who our audience is. And besides the fact that we are becoming that one-stop shop because we are landscape architects, planners, and now we convene a group of amazing individuals who can weld and build, and local subcontractors who are refugees and women and people of color from the communities that building the change they want to see in their own communities. For whatever reason, my blue hair tends to attract people as well. And they're like, man, this is a sister girl originally from Atlanta, Georgia. We need to be putting her on, but she also has her head shaved with blue braids. Like, she is who she is. How do we get on that? And sometimes it feels like, again, I'm a recipient of this gentrification thing where I'm this street art that's on the wall that people love to take a picture by, saying, yeah, see, it's a black girl right here and she has blue hair and I'm cool because I'm taking a picture next to her. But then the conversation shifts to, well, I actually, we want to buy something from you because
right.
You are that.
There's
cool
that
person.
Back door again.
Right. There's that back door again. So, you know, I wear my Auburn University shirt when I need to wear it, you know, and my husband, who's white, he'll go to a meeting when he needs to go without me. And then when it's time to sign the contract, I'll be there. So
will he wear a dashiki?
Yeah. He will. He will. He will. But it has to be, you know, it has to look, and it can't be tacky. You know,
right.
I haven't really found one that's tacky yet. But, yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, he's into the shea butter. He's into the, you know, all the cool shit that I've. That's who I am.
Right. Well, you know, it's really going to be interesting for my kids. So my kids, we live in the West End.
Yeah.
My kids go to Drew.
Yeah.
They are a low percentage of white people in their class.
Yep.
And so they've definitely grown up very differently than I have.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I grew up in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. There was one or two black kids in the whole school.
Sure.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then when my friends went to the University of Georgia,
mm-hmm.
it was pretty much the same thing,
mm-hmm.
right? White kids in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So my children have more friends of color than I certainly ever had,
mm-hmm.
but they still know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember early on my daughter saying, like, I don't like the West End.
Mm-hmm.
And she's sort of, I think she's changed that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, loud parties and stuff that we didn't have on the east side of town.
Yep.
And so I'm dying to know how they're going to view the world, because whatever I have, I know that affects them, right? Whatever inherent prejudices my wife and I have, like, you can't escape that and what society shows them. But the fact that they have, they're growing up in this different world than I grew up in, it's just going to be interesting to see how that goes long term.
Well, and you said something important. A lot of us in environmental biases that get pushed on kids, and so that's what they see as well. What they're taught to, what they're supposed to think and what they're supposed to feel and say. That's what they see all the time, and it is where parents come in. That's critical to say, hey, you know what? When I was at Auburn, what scared me the most was loud music and loud parties, because a lot of those students were wearing Confederate flag shirts.
Right.
It's the same loud party and loud music that I don't like on the West End. In fact, I almost got into a brawl with some my husband and I did, with some young people who thought it was cute to do that shit at 2-3 o'clock on the Monday morning, and it wasn't.
Oh, I almost got into an altercation on Memorial Day.
And it was like, how dare you? You're a black woman, and we're black, and I'm like, and your point. But the thing is, you're being in the community and not of it.
So I got to tell you, when I was the guy telling everybody to stop playing loud music, I had a conversation because of this show and Facebook groups. And there's a lot of nastiness that can happen on social media, but I've also said to somebody, let's not do this. Let's get in person. This dude came to my front porch and I forget his name, but he said something very wise to me. He said, you know what? Why don't you just not be the guy that calls the cops for a little while? Let somebody else in the neighborhood kind of take that role on. Yep. And I heard it and I got it.
Yes. Yep.
Memorial Day, there was fireworks. And when I say fireworks, I don't mean some snap, crackle, pop. I mean some legit, the fuck is that?
I know.
And it was, I thought it was behind my house, but it was right in front. Okay. So I live on White Street. Here's Rose Circle Park. They're right here. And I went out there and yelled, because it was 9:30. Hey, dude, we live here.
Yep.
We live here.
Yep.
Cut the shit.
Right.
And it was different than when I first moved in, and I was like, the new whites, I know these people aren't from this neighborhood.
Right.
Like, I can, they're not of this street and of this hood. And it kept going, and I did something very foolish that my wife was not happy, and I went out there and I walked over and I kicked the thing, and dude came running after me and they held him back and I called the cops and I was pissed. I felt violated because, this is our street, and I know you're not doing this where you live, and where the next day there's now shit everywhere, right? And I didn't even hear it at the time because it was heated. A dude threw a bottle at me. Again, my wife was like, you're an idiot. Please don't do that. Right?
Yeah.
And apparently one of the things they did was they called me 45. Do you know what that means?
What's 45?
So I love that you don't even know what it means. It means Trump, because he's our 45th president. I didn't, right?
That's terrible.
Well, my neighbor said, you didn't hear them call you that? And so, again, it's like, nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, I see why they said it. Yeah.
But you are fucking up my street at 10:30 at night. And
I see why they said it.
Right?
But see, when it happened with us, nobody could call me that. What they called me was a bitch.
Well, of course.
Which is why my husband flipped out.
Right.
They could call him that. And so it's one of those things where you have to be very strategic as to who you send out to do what job. And I think as a black person, for me, I think about it quicker and more than my husband would. And actually, we joke about this, because I tell him, you see these injustices, but you can't just be out here doing that. You're going to get me arrested. You're not going to be arrested. I'm going to get arrested, because you have the privilege that I don't, that you can do that. And he's never had to think about that before. And it's like, so I said, it's okay. So when things happen, send me out for certain things.
Right.
And I'll send you out for certain things, in order to get the situation resolved. And that's what I mean by this very, you have to think multidimensionally with all of these things, because these systems have everyone so hyper uptight about putting out just buzzwords when they don't really even know what they mean. And that's what I meant by when I said gentrification, is you have to define it for yourself. So when someone calls you 45, I definitely get why they said that. They don't get why they said that.
Right.
In a way. Because clearly that's, you're nowhere close to what that is. But that's, but what they see on the, on, and you know the answer to this, what they see is white guy in a community that I don't even live in, but just the fact that he's white and he's here. And then not even know their history, because let's be clear, you know, the biggest, some of the biggest advocates in the history of not just Atlanta, but in civil rights history and African-American history have been white people, and especially in the Jewish community. It's, and in West End, let's be clear. So that's not being, and that's why I said we've got to teach this history in our schools, and if not in our schools, in our families, to say, hey, this is how it used to work. This is what how these were the movers and shakers that even got us to this point today, to even have these communities where we have them. The problem though is we don't control our own narrative. Other people who look like you and my husband control the narrative, and there's no ownership in that. So there has to be a lesson in a conversation around what that actually means. And it's funny because immediately after my Community and Creative Mornings talk, someone who was at the talk, and I forgot his name, but he sent me a message on Instagram like 2 days later. And he's like, yo, it was a brother. He said, Jay-Z just said exactly what you just said. Look at this Twitter feed. And it was Jay-Z talking about after, you know, what happened with Nipsey in L.A. and in California. And he's like, It was similar to what I was saying, a little bit different. Of course, Jay-Z is, you know, just amazing at words and as a lyricist. He's like, we gotta control our own neighborhood. We gotta gentrify our own neighborhoods. And when he said we gotta gentrify our own neighborhoods, the Twitter I said, I know what people are gonna say.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of African Americans like, how dare he make that kind of statement? How dare you say? And I'm like, you missed the whole fucking point of what he was meaning, because your definition of gentrification is only what 45 looks like, and not what you look like in your right. own mirror. You know? So let's be clear. So these are, and people don't want to have that conversation, and Black people don't want to have it either. But that's what we get. That's what we have to start doing. That's where we come in. We are the ones. And in fact, a lady told me years ago, I was in New York at City Lab and Aspen Institute, and there's a young lady from China. She's a real estate developer, and her work was quite interesting. She was trying to figure out how to redevelop the historical Chinese squares, because they're getting gentrified, you know, according to what she said, from tourists and all these kinds of things, pushing out the historical architectural relevance of what has been there for centuries, for years. And she said, well, Nona, this is what you're going to have to do. I only knew her for about 15 minutes after talking. And she said, you're going to have to be that individual or that company, that entity that balances the grassroots with the high wealth. Nobody is doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is creating a language that combines the two. Nobody builds tables, literally builds tables and spaces that connects and convenes the two. You're gonna have to do that. You're gonna have to create that connective tissue, that restitching of the high growth resource and the high growth individuals with the grassroots. That's where we sit, and most people don't sit in that space. And people don't build for that space. They're either one end of the spectrum. There's nobody. We cannot continue to move forward in a progressive way and talk about equity if no one like us is there. That's what our value is. And that's what I mean by, if you want to pay me $1 million to do a container home, I'll do it, because that $1 million is going to go towards this effort of restitching that. The problem, though, is, and it goes back to what I said about this microwave bitch syndrome, is that that takes time. And people don't want to invest in what takes time. They want to invest in some quick dating app that has nothing to do with people trying to survive on the street. Like, who cares? Like, I mean, that's great. I mean, I've done it. I've seen it. But that, how does that solve the problems? So we're hitting on, when they called you 45, that was hitting on a symptom, but that wasn't hitting on the problem, and it wasn't hitting on the problem that person was causing. Just like for us, when my husband and I went out there, they had a bat in my hand because it was 20 people against us, and they sitting up there holding, you know, posters and shit saying filming the police and Black Lives Matter, but you want to call the police on me and call me a bitch, you know, a Black woman a bitch, and somehow my life matters to you. And then my husband is out here and he's like, you know, you people are doing this. And they said, you people, all this racist white man. And I'm like, you don't even know what the hell you're talking about.
Right.
Because you're gentrifying more than me. What you're doing is causing a rift in this community for people to think that this community doesn't matter because of how you're acting. So who's a gentrifier now? And then you call the cops on me, which was actually pretty funny. So when the cops came, an hour later, literally an hour later, they were shining the flashlight at us. I was sitting on the porch because I knew something was going to pop off. I'm like, we're not over with this, right? And they were like, hey, y'all seen the crazy woman with a bat running around the neighborhood? And I was like, no, but I have a bat. And I was eating granola we had just made the night before on the porch, like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And he was like, well, where's your bat? And I was like, it's in the house. And he was like, why you got a bat? And I'm like, because it was 20 ass wipes against two. What you think? And he said, well, what was it all about? And so I started telling him. He said, wait a minute. There were some calls earlier about some loud music and past the ordinance. I was like, yeah, that was them. Well, why the hell they call us for? You had every right to defend yourself. You're absolutely right. We're sorry, ma'am. And that was it.
Right.
And so
police also did not come in a hurry when I called them in my neighborhood, but it's another story.
You know what was funny? Not only did they come, they came like five deep. I mean, you would have thought somebody had dropped a bomb in our community. Like, they had the whole street blocked off because of me with my bat. Like, it was hilarious. And when they found out that they wasted their resources on that, they were hot. They were like, that's unacceptable. You know, they were cursing. They're like, what the fuck are we out here for? You know, what is this? You know, and so I was like, well, damn, that's some good, that's some, y'all came pretty deep. I'm glad to see y'all are coming, but y'all coming for the wrong thing. That surprised me, but they were out there.
Right.
But they were hot. And so what I've learned through working in local government and seeing the other side of things, again, being that gentrifier, the way I define gentrification, one of my areas of that I'm good at doing is community engagement, and the sauce to, I think the magic sauce to that community engagement and that backdoor strategy is that remember when I said you have to know how to when which one of us goes out for the fight at the right time, and how do you do that? There's a strategy to that, and what I mean by that is, when I was working for city government and I would do community engagement initiatives and events and programming, I started this innovation center. It was the first of its kind in that city some years ago. And what I did was that worked was that I was the resourceful individual because I worked for the city. I had some funding and I was getting paid to do the work. But I actually put citizens, kind of like NPUs that we have here in Atlanta, but I put the citizens in charge of the operation. So each citizen represented their district, their network. They made the rules. They created the playbook. All I did was sit back and help them when they needed my help. I wasn't there to empower them because they had their own power. I just got the hell out of the way. They made it work because they knew their constituents. That was their face. They controlled the narrative. If I walked in there and by the way, and any time I went to the community for a meeting, I never said I worked for the government until about maybe 10 minutes after.
Because they know they're going to turn you off immediately.
They knew because that was the face. Because even though I looked like the people in the room, I was still the government.
Right.
And so that's not the...
the man.
Yeah.
As I was when I asked them to not do fireworks right. In the middle of the night, right. I was looked at as the man.
Right. That's right. You were looked at as 45, which is the most insulting, disgusting thing that anybody...
But dude, here's the thing is I didn't hear it. And even if I had, I wouldn't know what it meant. But my neighbor...
Right.
I didn't heard it. She, you know, she texted me. She goes, they were calling you 45. I go, what's that?
Look, I'm sitting here thinking about 45. What new thing is this? So I learned something new from it too. And it's funny because my husband, when I did that creative morning speech, I had never talked to him about my how I feel about being a gentrifier and someone who's a recipient of it. I never talked to him. I never talked to anybody. That was the first time I ever said that in public.
Really?
Yep. And he didn't know what I was going to say.
I assumed that was like your pitch because it was the first time I heard it, but it was so impactful and so right on.
It was the first time I had ever, I mean, that has been my pitch, but I had never said it that way out loud.
Were you nervous?
No.
Okay.
I'm not, once I'm on stage, I don't get nervous. But
before you go on stage?
A little bit, only because typically when I do talks, I don't know what I'm going to say until the night before. So I didn't know that everything that I said, I didn't know until that Thursday. And the talk was on Friday. So that's why I was nervous. I was only nervous so I wouldn't forget what I was going to say. Every time, I never know what I'm going to say until the day before.
Right.
So, but once I got up there, and so my husband, I was, you know, you're trying to get a feel for the crowd, but you're really not paying that much attention. I'm like, well, fuck it, I'm up here now. It is what it is. If you like me or you don't, but I'm going to say what I feel. And when we finish, he said, I am almost, he's like, I was so jittery, I was almost in tears. Because he said, what you said as a white man about feeling that awkwardness of being the gentrifier, of course, he never has had been the recipient of that the way I have as a black woman. But that gentrifying, but being married to a black woman in West End, in Atlanta, in my hometown, as a white man, you know, in this house that used to be the drug house in that part of West End, he's like, that's rough. But how do I voice that? What does that mean? Would I say it? But the fact that you said it as a black woman, he said, you have no idea what that meant to me. And I never, and that hit me whole in a whole different way for my husband to say that. And I was like, wow, yeah, I didn't think about that. I'm just telling you my experiences. And then what even made it better was the sisters that came up to me, and the brother that said, yo, I'm dealing with the same shit. Like, I'm moving into Atlanta, or I'm from here, but I'm moving to a different neighborhood. Now I'm the damn problem.
Mm-hmm.
What am I supposed to say? And so apparently what I was saying resonated with both sides of the spectrum, from the high wealth resources to the grassroots. And I realized that maybe finally I'm becoming that individual that young lady said that I needed to be, which was the connector between the two, because I have been on both sides. And not just both sides, because I live in a home that we've renovated that is part of increasing the property taxes. We can barely pay our property taxes as far as I'm concerned. But because I also work for government. Like, I worked in the very thing that has been the bullhorn for land use segregation and for housing segregation and for racial strife. I work for that shit. And it's deep. And this is one of my wish on my wish list too. I wish everyone had the opportunity. I wish there was a program where the city governments, especially of major cities, can hire citizens part-time for at least 4 years, just so people can see why things don't work the way they should. Just so you can know how to ask the right question to get a certain answer, so you can understand why we're in the situations that we're in. You know, I did a project with some middle schoolers back in Durham. And this was a middle school where people say, you know, the behavioral problem students, predominantly black, brown students, same old shit you hear here in the city of Atlanta too. And yes, they were problem students because they didn't have the resources and they had terrible home lives. Go figure. And so I was part of this program called Citizen Schools, which is a national program where you are a citizen teacher, volunteer your time to do it. And I had never done it before in my life. And it literally, I probably aged like 50 years. Like, man, shit, I can't, teachers need to get paid more money for this. This is hard. But one of the things that I did was because it was just teach whatever you're good at. One of the things that I did was I had these students, they were 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. Of course, by that age, they think they know everything anyway. Mm-hmm. And mixed use of students. You know, whites, there was a couple of white students in there, predominantly black and brown students. And I had them put a big piece of paper on the floor, and I said, I want you all to draw your neighborhood. Just draw your neighborhood. And I'm Mrs. Developer. So I let them draw. They were getting all drawn their little playground and all these little things, basketball courts, houses, parks, trash cans, trash in the street. I mean, they drew exactly what they're used to seeing. So then I said, time. And I took a marker and I drew on top of their neighborhood, like Walmart and some other big box things. Boy, they got pissed. And I said, now draw around it. So at first they were like, I don't understand what. So I said, just draw around it. So they started drawing. They were a little bit more quiet, a little bit kind of irritated. So then I said, time. Then I drew a luxury condo. Man, they literally got in my face and started cursing. What the hell are you doing, Winona? I said, no, I'm not Winona, I'm a developer. Why are you doing this? Why are you drawing over our community? That's not right. This is bullshit. Like, how can you do this? You don't have the right. And I said, oh, but I do have the right because of who I am and who I know and the money that I have. You don't. What the F do you mean? Da, 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 da. And I can't believe this. And this is why we're in a situation we're in now. I said, bingo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was funny was there was this one student who wasn't understanding what was happening, and she's like, no, Miss Developer, draw some more Walmarts. And they were like, no, are you crazy? She's obliterating our community. That's not what this is about. And I said, but what are you going to do about it? So this young, and I talked a little bit about this at Creative Mornings. This young man, Dylan, was like, well, why should I give a shit about what happens? Nobody cares about me. And I said, you know what? That's a valid statement. And he said, this is why. Because you come in here, you do whatever you want, and you don't give a shit about us kids, and da-da-da-da-da. I said, you're absolutely right. I don't give a shit about you. I'm a developer. Why should you? I don't live here. And one girl was, she, I mean, she was just fighting angry. And she's like, well, maybe I need to go to law school. Maybe, is there something that I could do? And I said, well, there's something called, there's property rights law. Well, what's that? And the more that was that engaged them to realize that there's more opportunity than they think to make a difference. And this one young, she was a young Mexican student, and she said, but Miss Winona, I can't go to college or I can't go to trade school. Why not? Because I was told that I couldn't. Oh, that's not true. So then it switched from, I had to improvise real quick. I felt like some blues or jazz singer. I had to like switch it up. And so I switched it up and said, okay, we're going to do some intros to colleges around the world. And I'm going to have you draw using paint outside. We actually also built them a courtyard space. It was donated. So they started spray painting college logos, MIT or University of Hawaii or North Carolina Central or Howard. And I had them look at the logo, spray paint the logo on the courtyard pavers, and then study the schools. I got so much negative backlash from some of the teachers.
Because
they said that I was promoting graffiti, and because I was not promoting their colleges that they went to. I don't give a shit what college you went to. Talk about it.
Right.
Or if you can't because you're in this educational system, let me do it in peace. Because I'm reaching these kids in the way that you haven't, and that's okay. But the point of it is they now know that they have an option to do something else as best as they can, or at least to ask the right questions. So then I started teaching them planning and land use. What is zoning? What does that mean? And at the end of that semester, Dylan, the same kid who said, why should I give a shit? He said, now I get it, because if I don't care, nobody else is going to care. And I said, that's all I wanted from you. And I left feeling defeated because of this. And then I almost got arrested twice in that school. Because, you know, in schools like that with mostly black and brown students, you got to have police every five fucking damn feet. So the police thought I was a student. Instead of asking me who I was, who are you? Why are you on a hall? I mean, that's, and I'm like, if you're talking to me like that, then right. You go, and of course, you know, I'm an adult. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking to? And I work for the city. Now we about to have a problem. So teachers literally had to run out to stop them from arresting me, thinking that I was some student wandering the hall when I'm building courtyards and
right.
shit. And then I had a car, this old breakdown car delivered to the courtyard for the students to paint over and grow vegetables out of to turn something ugly into something beautiful. You know, the principal had that taken out.
Because
it was ugly, and he never asked why we were doing what we were doing. He didn't provide any resources. I'm sorry, the superintendent. The principal was excited. The superintendent
right.
had it out. And of course, he then got he was guilty, I think indicted of misusing public funds or something weird happened. Go figure. But I struggled not with these beautiful babies, but with the adults in the room who said that they were supposed to be teaching these beautiful babies things, but in fact were the total opposite. I love them as long as they go home to their neighborhood, they don't live next to me. So it goes back to this whole notion of who are we actually educating and building for, and who aren't we? And what are we educating them for? And so I would go home defeated, and I told my grandmother, and I'm like, man, this is just rough, man. These kids, they're being fussed at like this. How can they learn? I'm trying to show them why they are. At least let's talk about the actual problem. Like, why are you angry? Like, you should be angry, but why are you angry? Like, for real. Let's start with that, because nobody's asking you anything. And my grandmother said to me, she said, trust and believe. Those kids got exactly what you said. You might not know it or think it. Kids aren't stupid. Somebody, even if it's not all of them, one or two people got what you said. And that has resonated with me today with going back to what I said earlier about I don't need 100 people to get what we're doing. I need 10 grassroots and 10 high wealth. That's all I need in a couple of developers with some fucking money. I don't need 100 people. I just need 10 backdoor recipients, people who will open their alleys and their back doors to me, their 8 feet, and say, let's make a difference by putting one of your plug-in pods and building equity right here. And don't care about their neighbors, because my husband, he's just waiting. He is waiting literally for some 45, real 45-ish, to move next door so he can just have, give him a reason to say something.
Right.
You know, no, we're going to use my yard because I'm doing it. It's my property. It's funny how you want your property a certain way, but when I move next door, all of a sudden now it's your property. Now, no, that's not how that works.
Right.
So, but again, that's what I mean by being a recipient of all of this and being on the other side of things and seeing things for what they are. I think it seemed like it was this miserable joke that somebody was playing on me, but it was actually now a gift. That in order to really understand the problem, you have to have been a recipient of that problem and to be focused now on the solution versus the symptom. And we keep focusing on symptoms, and building more Beltline is a symptom. It's not solving the actual problem because we're not talking about the actual problem. So we've approached some developers on the East Side Trail to use some of their parking spaces and parking decks and for the plug-in pods. They're not ready yet. What they're waiting for really is for us to build them again on the west side.
Mm-hmm.
That's the issue. And we're not going to wait for that. We're going to start yard by yard or Lenox Square Mall parking lot by Lenox Square Mall parking lot and do it that way. And that's how humans are. They wait. They follow, you know, but all of us we can't afford to do that. So that's where we are now. Yes, we are actively looking for manufacturing space and investors who believes in what we're doing because they are out there. We're bombarded with negative shit, but we forget that there are people who actually are doing some cool stuff. And luckily, you know, you are helping to expand our narrative. But there are people, and people with money who, I mean, it's a drop in the bucket. Like $3.2 million for a manufacturing space to build 10 to 20 homes in 90 days, if that. Like it's a joke if you really have the resources. It's a quarter, right? And so that's where we are. That's what we do.
All right. So tell people, website, social media accounts.
Yes. So our website, so there's two websites. So if you want to learn more about me and that story and that being the recipient and being a gentrifier, you can visit my website, which is my name. So it's www.winonasatcher.com. It's not Winona, it's not Winona, it's W-A-N-O-N-A, Winona, Satcher, S-A-T-C-H-E-R.com. And on that website, you'll see videos, pictures, but you'll also see links to my businesses. Or you can go to the business page, makersstudio.com. So it's www.makers, M-A-K-H-E-R-S, like makersstudio.com for Makers LLC. I'll admit, it's not the coolest and prettiest website because that's just not what I do, but it has enough information to get what we are doing with our business. And then you can also fill out a form, which is the best way to reach us from a business standpoint. If you're interested in our shipping containers, to learn more, to come and see one. If you want one as an accessory dwelling unit or as a cool live-work unit, or if you're a developer, if you're an artist and need some artist space or studio space, if you're a hip-hop artist, whatever the case is, we can accommodate. And we would love to bring you on as kindred spirits in our social impact space, which is to take over the world every 8 feet.
Do you have Instagram?
I do. So my Instagram and Twitter feeds, both personal ones, you can follow me there as well, Wajisa, W-A-J-I-S-A. Which are the two first initials of each of my names, my first, middle, and last. And then I also have a Makers Studio, spelled the same way, M-A-K-H-E-R-S Studio, Instagram page, where I try to put pretty much everything is container-related and business-related and conference-related. My other personal is just personal stuff and some container stuff. But, yeah, you can visit me there. And then Twitter, I'm always on social media, as you can see. So Twitter's the same way, at Wajisa, or at Makers Studio. As well, but usually among my personal one more than that. We are, soon we'll be revamping our newsletter so we can start updating everyone since we did our first crowdfunding campaign through ifundwomen.com. Shout out to ifundwomen because that's a great crowdfunding platform for women-owned businesses. But wanting to update those donors who helped us with raising funds to build our first plug-in pod, the one in West End. That was a $20,000 unit. We built in 22 days, so we can show you what you can do quickly, but quality. And then update those donors, but as well as update everyone else who's interested in following our story as we evolve and grow into a global company, knock on wood. That's what our wish list is. And so that's where we are. You can find me, it's a little bit of information about me also on Ignite HQ, which is a co-working space in Social Lab in Marietta. The Mark Hubbard, who runs that, the CEO, who's awesome, he heard me speak on a talk show out in Silicon Valley about what we do and found out about me here. And so he's been one of our friends and advocates of what we do. And they highlighted me a month ago on their platform as well. So we're out and about. But if you put my name, Winona Satcher, in Google, a whole shitload of stuff will come up. And it'll probably all lead to my website. And you can see more articles and podcasts, hear more podcasts, and see what we're doing. I try to update that as well. So those are the best ways to contact me. My email address is also on the websites. And don't be afraid. My cell phone number is still a North Carolina number. It is not a 404-678 or 770, but it is me. Hopefully we'll be getting a 404 or something when we get our manufacturing space. So that's how you can contact me. I'm here. West End is the best end. Atlanta born and raised. So feel free to contact me anytime. I'd love to hear everyone's story, how we can help, and how we can find that 8 feet for you and start building some plug-in pods.
There we go. That is going to do it. Thank you so much for listening. Do me a favor. Share this podcast. Tell a friend. Your friends are always asking you, what should I be listening to? What do you like? And what you can do for me as a favor, as this awesome free content, is to tell a friend to listen to the Atlanta podcast. Also, shout out RCR Video, the studio in which I record these videos, the studio where I'm sitting right now. They're actually called RCR Video. I called them RCR Studios for a long time. They are, in fact, RCR Video. I called this place RCR Studios. Do you have to make some videos, some video content, some stuff about your company to tell the world about it? These guys are the place you want to do it. Not just saying that because I'm sitting here. It's because they do great work. Drop me a note. We'll get you hooked up. Also, I've had people ask me about recording here. You can come here and record podcast as well. Hit me up and let you know how you can make that happen. All righty. Gotta run. Love you, Mission Minute. Gotta run. See you around, ATL.